If you could wave your magic wand, what would that look like in this vision of yourself in a future state?
I think it would look like a studio full of kids who practice and work really hard, and parents who are supportive, yet also flexible. And I think it would be having time to just sit down with some coffee and a book every day, too.
And what would that feel like, sitting down with coffee and a book?
That would feel amazing.
Sarah Bylander-Monska has a rich education in music.
I came to the Suzuki Viola as a 12-year-old. Had many years of traditional piano lessons. Just wanted to practice on my own. Went off to college. Viola was my main instrument. Really needed to know my instrument well. Double majoring in viola performance and music education. I also was taking Dalcroze pedagogy. Got a job doing some early childhood classes that were Dalcroze inspired. Knew that I wanted to be a teacher. Enjoyed focusing on the performance aspect as well.
Sarah had a rich musical background and many options for directing her music career. She could have taught the whole body music practice of Dalcroze. She could have performed or conducted orchestras. Instead, why did she choose to work primarily with individual students and delve into Suzuki teaching?
I'm always ready to talk about Suzuki.
You're listening to Building Noble Hearts, a production of the Suzuki Association of the Americas. I'm Margaret Watts Romney. Here, we're taking a look at the learning environments in which children, parents, and teachers gain new knowledge and are encouraged to become fine individuals as well. We're talking with members of the Suzuki music community inspired by humanitarian violinist Shinichi Suzuki, and we're finding themes of good teaching everywhere, such as listening, community, creativity, and more.
I'm always ready to talk about Suzuki.
Suzuki teachers have a way of meeting each child where they are, but at the same time holding a vision for their potential and a vision of excellence for their future. And to be able to hold those two concepts in one's mind at the same time, I think is a sign of a great teacher in any subject matter. So I see that more frequently with Suzuki teaching. I don't want to say it's exclusive to Suzuki teaching, but I see it in many of my colleagues that I observe around the country.
I have to admit, as a teacher myself for over 20 years, this comment surprised me. I knew many pillars of Suzuki teaching, many that we've mentioned here. Listening, parent support, small steps, group learning, repetition. But I didn't recognize this particular skill of holding two concepts in my mind at the same time. Then I thought about what I'd learned in a Suzuki course based on the ideas of Dr. Robert Duke called Suzuki Principles in Action. This idea of envisioning accomplished learners has become part of the fabric of our understanding of teaching and is rooted in the ideas of Dr. Suzuki himself. Dr. Suzuki encouraged teaching character, the whole child, not just teaching a 5-year-old to play Bach or the individual fourth finger on the left hand to play in tune. He said, "What is man's ultimate direction in life? It is to look for love, truth, beauty." He said, "Teaching music is not my main purpose. I want to make good citizens." These are admirable goals, and every day, Suzuki music teachers still have to figure out how to teach the 5-year-old to play Bach or the individual fourth finger on the left hand to play in tune. How do we do both? How can we practice
meeting each child where they are, but at the same time holding a vision for their potential?
I wanted to hear more about Sarah's experiences. How did she accomplish this Jedi mind in two places trick? And were there other places that it would be useful?
I think it has to happen at the teacher level, and it has to happen at the parent level. And then I feel like we have a responsibility, parent and teacher together, to help the child be able to see that as well. So that the child starts to create a vision for themselves as an accomplished learner and a performing artist and somebody who can get up and present themselves and be part of a group and make a meaningful difference in a musical experience.
Teachers, parents, and students, we can all take this skill and apply it to many different roles. First, let's take a look at how a teacher can help adults focus on the present while holding a vision for the future.
One of the things that I love best about my job at Music Institute is that I run the parent orientations. And so I think a lot of these parents come in with preconceived expectations of what this musical experience is going to be and what this journey is going to be like learning a musical instrument. As musicians, we know that learning a musical instrument, each instrument has its own set of rules, and you just can't get around that. The violin has to be played a certain way in order to get a beautiful sound. It requires really careful foundation work, which for a child can sometimes be tedious. Parent orientations are a time where I like to help them understand that it is a journey that takes effort over time.
And I want to say just one more thing about that. I feel that when you're with a child and in that moment that child doesn't want to practice, it's really easy to forget about the long haul and all of these beautiful character traits that we're developing. And so I always encourage parents when they begin to write down a list of all of the different traits and qualities that they hope to see developed in their child through their musical study, so that in those moments of struggle, they can sit down with that list and remember, right, this is why we're doing it. We're doing it so that my child can stand up in front of an audience with poise and listen and be a team player and remember all of those qualities that are developed over the long term.
This is a strategy Sarah uses in many different ways with her students. Everything from preparing them for what a recital will feel like to very simple lesson etiquette.
I think the best example of that would be something that happened just a few months ago with one of my very young students. This is a little one who has enormous potential on the viola, but then suddenly, kind of out of nowhere, he was not exhibiting what I would define exemplary lesson behavior. Doing the opposite of what I was asking him to, or not cooperating, or not staying in the same place for his lesson where he needs to be staying, maybe walking over to the couch and then walking back whenever he wanted to. Just little things that were suddenly starting to add up. It made for lessons where he wasn't able to learn. And I have a vision for him not only as a violist, but also as an accomplished learner, somebody who knows how to take information and knows how to work with a teacher and knows how to take in new concepts. So we just did a reset. And this is maybe an example of how I would use visioning with a very young one, because he's 4 years old. So we stopped everything and sat down on the floor with a piece of paper. And I just asked him, what are three things that students should be doing in lessons? And we had a conversation, and I think we came up with feet will stay in the lesson area. The student does what the teacher asks. I think the other one was something like no yelling. And he wasn't ever yelling, but that was his idea, that students shouldn't yell in lessons. So we wrote just those three things down. And suddenly there was a very clear path and a vision for this is what the expected lesson behavior is. We ended our lesson that day a little early, and then the next day I met him in the hall with that list, and we talked about it. And I reminded him how I expected him to enter the room. And each step along the way, we kept checking with that list to see how he was doing. And I made sure to always check when he was doing all three of those things, so that we could celebrate and say, wow, are you yelling? No, I'm not. Oh my goodness, isn't this amazing? Are you cooperating? Yes, I am. And have your feet left the lesson area? No, I haven't run to the couch even once, so that we could have a lot of time to celebrate. We used this to touch base and see how he was doing with just lesson behavior. And after a few lessons using that list, then it was all fine and we haven't had to use it again. But I think that that's maybe an example of making a clear vision for something and then having the child help himself get there.
It turns out that Sarah applies this philosophy of holding future visions to the Suzuki Association of the Americas. As board chair of the SAA for several years, Sarah has always kept an eye not only on where the organization is now, but where it should be going in the future as well.
As a board member, I have a vision for our organization, a Suzuki Association, and a world where any children who wants this can have it, and any parent who wants this for their child can have it. And it's not something that's elite or expensive or inaccessible. You know, that's the vision that I have in my mind all the time when I'm doing this board work. How can we get there? And then we just constantly assess that vision for the future against what's in front of us today and slowly, step by step, move in that direction.
Sarah isn't the only professional who uses this technique of holding two thoughts in your head at once, visioning your future while being in the present. Business consultant and TEDx speaker Patty Dabrowski told a story on the podcast That Got Me Thinking about a room of adults in distress that shifted when she helped them vision their future.
And I go into this one company and everybody is so upset. Like literally in the room, they're throwing things and they're crying and I'm a wreck. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not at all skilled at this. I'm a therapist, a drama therapist, but this is like way more drama than I know how to deal with. So I just went into the restroom, I locked the door and, you know, I just like asked, like, what am I supposed to do here? And then, you know, I believe that genius or creative genius is accessible to everybody. And in that moment, I got an idea and I went back in the session. I put paper on the walls and I had everybody take a pen and go up there and write and draw where they were right now. And then after they'd done that, suddenly everybody was really calm. And then I said, well, okay, a year from today, what do you want it to be like? You know? And so they began to tell me what they wanted. Best case scenario, and then we just close the gap between the two, current and desired. And as soon as I saw that happen, I knew that this was a tool that everybody should know how to do. You just get a blank piece of paper and a pen or colored pens if you want, but it doesn't matter. And first I do, just on a scratch paper, I do a little warm up. I just draw like a square, a circle, a triangle, a line, period, comma. Just so that I get myself to remember that all things in the world are made from these very common symbols. But it's better if you actually draw some pictures because you activate this other part of your neural cortex that will actually get you to think bigger. So on the left side, you write current reality and you capture in words and pictures, scatter them around the page on the left side, what it's like right now. Then you take a break, you get up, drink some water, do some jumping jacks, get yourself rebooted. And you write on the right side, desired new reality. And you imagine out as far as you want, it doesn't matter. And I capture it in words and pictures. And I start with the qualities and characteristics because it's easy to get to. Maybe I want to be more creative. Then I add a few pictures to like, what would that specifically look like? Finishing that book you've always wanted to write. You know, I put the specifics. And then I've got the current and the desired, and then I just put three big arrows there, and I write at the top three bold steps. And I look at the data on the left, the data on the right, and I close my eyes for a second, and this is that me in that restroom, what are the three boldest things I could do to get from here to there? And as soon as I get something, I write it down. So you have to catch it right away. And then I take action on those three things. I just do something.
Visioning into the future and connecting it to the present can help parents, students, organizations, and even ourselves make a list, draw pictures, shape the visions in our minds into a reality. After all the visioning and hands-on work Sarah has done in her studio and at the SAA, it seemed natural to ask, what does she vision for her own future?
I'm starting to take a little bit more time to play things that aren't so teaching related. I just started taking Scandinavian fiddling lessons, and I'm starting to come back to music as something that's not just my career, but something that's there for me. So that's been a really nice feeling too. I think sometimes we get our instruments out to teach and to perform when we need to perform on a faculty recital or something like that, but it's important every now and then to take that instrument out just to play for yourself.
Parents, students, leaders, ourselves, this skill of being able to hold two concepts in one's mind at the same time, of our current reality and our vision of the future, is a powerful tool and an opportunity. Maya Angelou summed it up best when she said, "If we are lucky, a solitary fantasy can transform a million realities." Do you have an influential educator in your life like Sarah that you would like to recognize? Lillian Chow, Gail Gerding Mellert, and Carol Ureta are some of the people who have stars named in their honor in the Giving Galaxy of Stars on the SAA website. Go to SuzukiAssociation.org to dedicate a star, and we may acknowledge them here on the podcast as well. Our theme music, Sun Up, is composed by Stephen Katz and Derek Snyder and performed by the Snyder Cello Army. Thank you to Ellie Newman and the That Got Me Thinking podcast for the use of their interview with Patty Dobrowski. You can find them at ellienewman.com and pattydobrowski.com. Dvorak Sonatina in G major, transcribed for viola, was played by Dima Marath and Vincent Plains. Beethoven Quartet No. 20 was played by the Jupiter String Quartet. Cothbrio and Kitchen Girls were played by the Real Vocal String Quartet. And Methuselah Podcast Productions gives masterful support to our scripts and production. Want to attend a Suzuki Principles and Actions course or learn more about Suzuki teaching? Check out the events tab at SuzukiAssociation.org. If you like what you heard today, give us a rating and a review on iTunes so more people can find us. Thanks for the great response from our listeners, and we'll see you next time.